3, 2, 1, 0. Welcome to episode 20 of Fresh Out of Tokens podcast. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher of Tyr. Everywhere online, if you find another one, sadly someone has chosen to imitate me. I'm sorry. And to the right of me is my co-host and producer, David, if you want to say hello.
Hello. It's great to be back.
Yeah, you just came back from Seattle, right?
Yes.
Awesome. And I am very, very excited to say we have another David with us, David Gator of BioWare. I want to say hi.
David number two. Hi. How's everyone doing?
It's been an interesting day at work. So my day job was a deadline day today that we're recording. So I'm very glad to be home and not at the office.
I know how you feel.
Yeah, that's why I have a little chocolate stout with me for sipping in between questions.
Good idea.
Yes, and you know, we cuss whatever you feel like doing, that's totally fine. So I'll give our usual spiel before we get into questions. So for anyone new to the podcast, we are part of the Geek.fm network along with Geeks and Sneaks, Chromatic Life, and More Than Bits podcasts. We have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games spreadsheet shop, and we split the profits 50-50 with Chachi Bobinks on Twitter. And there is a blog to compliment the show, so if you have questions, compliments, or hate mail, please don't send us hate mail. It will actually make me cry. Feel free to send us a note at outoftokenscast.wordpress.com. And with the usual to-do out of the way, let's get into our questions. So, David 2, or however, we'll figure this out as we go. So for those people who may be listening who may not know who you are, can you give us a little bit of background info?
Sure. Okay. I've been at BioWare for 17 years now, working as a writer. I started on Baldur's Gate 2. That was my very first project back in 1999, I believe. And that was just as a writer, and I worked on that and... let's see, Knights of the Old Republic, Neverwinter Nights. I think it was on the Neverwinter Nights expansion. Hearts of the Underdark was my first stint as a lead writer, which means I am directing a team of writers underneath me. And following that, I moved on to the Dragon Age series, which I was lead writer for until last year.
Yeah, that's a long time to be in one spot. Wow.
I tell you about it.
Yeah, I think the longest I've been at one job is 9 years. It felt like 20.
Yeah, no, I had a different job before then, but it wasn't in the game industry. So this is my one and only industry job. It's been exciting. And every now and again, I think maybe I should look somewhere else or see what else is out there. And then I'll have somebody at work who comes to us from elsewhere and basically says, "Hey, man, the grass is not greener." And I'm like, "Okay, good to know. Good to know."
As someone who still works in not the industry, not quite, don't do it. Just stay.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go out of the industry. Not if I had a choice anyway. But yeah. I mean, getting a job somewhere else other than BioWare. I suppose wherever you go, there are going to be issues, right? So, and I'm pretty happy where I am. So it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, I've been in my current day job for 5 years, trying to make that creep away from higher ed, though, because. It's a burnout job.
How is it? What does that mean?
Well, you know, not to devolve too far away from talk. My day job is an international student advisor, actually.
Oh, and, okay.
Yeah, so I not just advise students, but I have to deal with a lot of immigration regulations. And so today was the day where I'd report all 3,500 of our students to immigration and go, yes, they're here, they're not here, they're maintaining their status.
Okay.
So, yeah.
You're saying it's a real slog is what you're saying.
Yes, and I have no shame in saying this, because 5 years, like a lot of people, especially in the position I'm in, some people last a long time in it, other people leave like after a couple of years, and they're just like, nah, this isn't my thing, it's either too technical, or, because we have no choice, it's cut and dry, so that's not the most fun job to have.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, writing for video games, I think... people have the impression that it's a very sexy job. I think when people play, especially a BioWare game, even though the story is actually formed of many elements, there's gameplay, there's art, there's level design, I think people tend to experience it in the context of the writing. So they kind of have the impression that a writer is in charge of everything because it's really the context for everything they see. So whenever people are like, oh, I want to get into writing, and it's like, I hope when you say that, you're aware that it's a job like any other job, and that, you know, while I will freely admit there are many aspects to my job that are pretty sexy, that occasionally you get that day where it's like, wow, you know, nobody else gets to do what I do, that, you know, a good 75% of the job is a slog where you're doing things you don't necessarily want to do. You don't just write a script and hand it over to the rest of the team and say, make that you have to make a lot of compromises. It's not like writing a novel. It is a team effort, and it's work. So, you know, sometimes every now and again, we'll get a writer who starts, which isn't often because we don't hire new writers that often. But somebody will come in and they have this idea like writers are the idea people. And it's like, you know, game designers, we don't need idea people. The person whose ideas are important are the ones at the very top. They decide what games to make, and we use our ideas to try to make that game better. So you don't get a choice in everything you do. And I don't want to downplay it and say that, oh, that makes it suck. It's exciting, but you have to think of it as a group experience, and you're giving as much as you're taking, right? So I think that's a mistaken impression that people have about the job.
Yeah. So would you say, like, if you wanted to use like an analogy of film, that it's closer to being a director than a screenwriter?
No, it is close to being a screenwriter, but in the fact that you're doing the screenwriting, but there's different types of screenwriting. Even if somebody wrote a screenplay themselves, and like out of the blue, and it was everything they wanted, the chances that screenplay would get turned into exactly what they wrote without any changes are pretty minimal. Because, I mean, the director in this case is probably going to be your lead designer or perhaps even your executive producer on the project. They're the ones that decide exactly how things get made. So if there's a scene and they're like, well, the cinematographer says that in order to make the scene better, we should frame it like this. And you're like, well, that cuts down the scene by half. And he's like, well, yeah, but you got to let's cut the size of the scene down by half. Go do that. That's what you're going to have to do. A screenplay writer's job does not end with them turning in their initial script. Even if it wasn't a situation where they were asked to make a specific type of script, a screenplay writer has to sort of work with the director and everybody else who's making the movie and sort of to turn it from words on a page to something that's presentable in a certain type of media, right? Because the medium is the experience for the viewer. It's not just the words on the page. It has to be translated. So the screenplay writer has a lot of work to do along the way. It's not, I mean, I'm sure they would say the same thing. It's not as sexy as just I write what comes to my head and I turn it in. The director goes, oh, this is an awesome screenplay. And that's it, right? So it does have a lot in common with that. But I think a lot of people have the impression that a writer is the director when that's simply not the case.
All right. Thank you for clarifying. I do know with film, a lot of time you have a screenwriter who just writes a screenplay, and then between the director and the screenwriter, there's usually like someone like me who would doctor it.
Yes, I suppose I should have meant that to be that in the world of film, which I'm not overly familiar with.
It's fine.
I suppose it would be. Full writers involved and not just one person. I mean, I guess that's the same as in game writing, right? It's not I am the lead writer, but to say, oh, he wrote Dragon Age. No. I wrote chunks of Dragon Age, but there were up to seven or eight other writers working at the same time. And my biggest job, other than the actual writing that I do, is to coordinate that. And I mean, everybody is responsible for certain pieces. It's just simply too large for one person to write all of it.
Yeah, I can't imagine one person even writing half the content of one game.
It would take years.
Well, the ones we do, yeah. The ones we make, they're certainly... well, it does take years, even for a team to do it, so...
that's I meant like, more so.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, Inquisition, just as a single example, had about, 750,000 words. How many novels is that?
Oh, wow.
Say that number again.
750,000?
If it's like a new writer, that would be 9 or 10?
Yeah. That sounds about right. And I don't even think that includes things we wrote for, like, the codexes and such.
Yeah. I clarify new writer because established people get away with longer books.
Ah, yes. Yeah. The rapidly... Oh, no, it's the new Wheel of Time book, and it's...
All right. We should go into what... We should go into the question that always comes up very early on in this podcast and ask how you got into gaming.
You know, I don't really remember. And it's not just because I'm in my 40s. I don't remember ever not being into gaming. I remember being young and my neighbor, I lived in this little village in northern Manitoba. And the neighbor in the trailer next to us, I say trailer because they didn't have houses in that place, they got Pong, and I remember Pong and being very excited. They had this computer thing that would hook up to their TV, and it was just a very simple game. But I remember being fascinated by it, and to the point that as computers developed, my parents bought my brother and I. What was our first system? Oh, I want to say an early Atari. I remember when. Being able to save on a hard drive became a thing, and it blew my mind that you didn't have to keep using, inserting games that had like 24 separate floppy disks. And I just, I was into RPGs mostly, and it just was a thing. So I don't remember ever not being into gaming, but as a specific event, I can't really recall. My parents weren't very big on it. They, like when I was doing my tabletop RPG playing, they would just sort of look at me quizzically and be like, oh, you're playing that D&D's again. And I'd be like, ugh, I stopped playing Dungeons & Dragons. And they're like, oh, we don't even want to know the details. But I mean, between playing tabletop and CRPGs on computer, that was pretty much a lot of my existence. Although, I never honestly considered it in the idea of a job. Computer games got made in faraway places that had nothing to do with Canada. So it was never something I honestly considered that you could do for a living, for sure.
Well, funnily enough, that goes right into our next question, because you've talked about, this wasn't your first career. So what did you do before BioWare, and how did that kind of come about?
Oh, yeah, I've told this story a few places. I actually... worked in the service industry in hotels. And at the time, I was running a hotel, which coincidentally is it's a hotel that's right next to our current office at work. It was the hotel that I ran. But I was an operations manager running the hotel, and I didn't apply or anything. I had a friend who I knew worked in video games for a video game company, but I didn't know anything about it. Baldur's Gate 1 had come out, but I didn't connect the two. I didn't know that he had worked on that game. And I hadn't played it yet anyway, so I had only heard of it. So I guess they had finished Baldur's Gate 1 and were just starting Baldur's Gate 2, and they wanted to make it a lot bigger, and they realized they're going to need more writers. So the first thing they did was ask anybody who was at work, said, hey, if you know anybody who's done anything, any kind of game-related writing to completion, let us know. And my friend, who was a character artist there, Calvin Lyle, who's not with BioWare anymore, he's working for a company in England. But he gave them a set of rules that I'd written, a rule book for some game I was running amongst my friends. And James Olin, who was the lead designer on Baldur's Gate, he read that. He was like, oh, this is interesting. So he calls me out of the blue. And I was very suspicious. It was like, this isn't a job I had applied for, and you want me to come in and do what? Video game company here in Edmonton? Really? And he mentioned Calvin. I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, is that a thing? So I went in for this interview, and the offices we had back then were very dicey, and it's like something out of a set of Nightmare on Elm Street, just ducked. Anyway, and I talked to interesting. He asked for some examples of writing I'd done, and all I'd had was some short stories I'd written. Oh God, to think that I got hired based on those short stories, it's very sad. It's like nobody could get a job like that today. I just handed them over like, well, here's some short stories I've written. I guess that proves that I write. Although I think the ones I gave him I'd actually written in high school. You ever written anything you've written in high school? You ever read something like that?
Yep.
Yeah. So I was completely embarrassed, but we talked a lot about games, and I think he liked the fact that I knew Dungeons and Dragons very well, even though, yeah, at that point I hadn't played it in years. But it was second edition was my experience primarily, and he liked the background and stuff like that. So he was willing to take a chance, and we said, oh, we'll hire you. And I turned him down. It was a lot less money than I was making at the hotel. And I was like, well, I already have a career. And it really looked like BioWare was some fly-by-night company that could pick up any day and I would be out of a job. So I was like, thanks, but no thanks. And that was on Friday. And on Monday, I went into work at my hotel. And my boss from my regional manager was there to tell me that the management company I worked for had been bought out by another management company, and they were bringing in their own general manager. So I was let go on the spot because they don't let GMs stay around because they might take clients with them to another hotel. So I was walked out with my box of stuff from my desk, and I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll give that other job a try.
Oh, wow.
That's the story of how that happened, which is funny because, I mean, I think about it, you know, these days, I'm like, I guess that was just meant to be. That stupid me had said, this sounds really exciting to work on a video game and stuff. But of course, being conservative, and the voice of my parents in my head saying, oh, what if it folds up? You'll be out of a job. And I'm like, I better play it safe. And someone, you know, tapped me on the shoulder, said, no, this is what you're meant to do. So I feel extremely, you know, fortunate that despite my best intentions, I ended up exactly where I probably should be because I really enjoy this. I think I'm pretty good at it. So it worked out.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I wouldn't want to talk about, you know, faith a lot. People get squirmy when you do that, but it's that sort of thing that makes me think, you know, maybe there is a God. Maybe there's something to that. But, you know, that's a completely different topic, I'm sure.
We talk about everything on this show. If you feel the need or want to, go for it.
Cool.
Because, well, I mean, I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to any of the episodes, but what we want to do is have those conversations people aren't having about gaming. You know, go ahead. Sorry, I keep cutting you off.
No, I'm doing the same. I guess that's cool. I mean, it seems that when I do a lot of interviews, I always get asked exactly the same questions, which is fine. I don't mind, but it's cool to talk about sort of different aspects of the job as well.
Well, that, and it's like, you know, there's a lot of gaming podcasts, and how many different ways can people argue about Quiet or talk about a game is 10 out of 10 or 5 out of 10? It's like, okay, I can read, you know, magazines for that or go online to argue with someone about a game score. This is a deeper thing for us because, I mean, as you know, gaming is important and, you know, it's a culture and we want to have those conversations that aren't happening in a lot of spaces.
Yeah. Speaking of Quiet, no, I'm kidding.
When we talk about what we're playing, we can talk about Quiet because I've actually been putting in a lot of hours on Metal Gear Solid. So,
that character comes up everywhere.
I know. For a Quiet character, she's everywhere. I can't take it. I get in a good one on occasion. But before we get too derailed, I think David Reeves had the next question.
So you've worked on all three Dragon Age games, and your role on the team has always been as the lead writer with Dragon Age. But can you talk about that experience going from a designer on previous titles to the lead writer for Dragon Age, the series? And if there's anything pertinent to KOTOR you'd like to mention, that'd be great.
I don't think I had finished KOTOR. KOTOR and Neverwinter Nights are a blur for me because we actually worked on them around the same time. And I actually jumped from one to the other. So I know a few times when I've had to do sort of a timeline, okay, what projects did you work on? And I come to the KOTOR era and I'm like, God, which was first? Because we actually wrote an entire draft of KOTOR, which got thrown out. And then I had to work on Neverwinter Nights And then I had to work on the next draft of KOTOR. So I think KOTOR was afterwards, but then there were expansions for Never Tonight, which sort of came in between. So it's all this messy period. But I think I had to jump on Hordes of the Underdark. And I think that was sort of my test that was given to me, like, could I do lead writer work? And I think that James Olin was pretty satisfied with my work on Hordes. So at that point, I think BioWare was starting to get a little weary of working on other people's IPs, intellectual properties. And so they were looking at starting a couple of IPs of our own, one fantasy, one sci-fi. That's really the only information they had on them at the time. And James knew I sort of preferred fantasy over everything else. So he came to me and said, hey, why don't you come work on this fantasy IP we're looking at? At the time, the code name was Chronicle. And he said, well, you can sit down and design, create the world for it. And I'm like, you mean create the world like I'm working on my own kind of homebrew world for my tabletop? And he's like, yeah, sure. Just put together a bunch of notes and I'll see what you come up with. So I was like, oh, okay, sure. So it was a very small team at the time. There was only about 5-6 people at the time, because there was a group that was off working, so sort of what the gameplay might be. And I think they were kind of enamored with the idea of it being kind of like a Conan world. I mean, if you look, there was a point where we actually showed our tech video for the first Dragon Age in E3 years before we actually released. You could probably look it up online, and it has like it's using the Never Tonight's engine, and it has like a bare-chested barbarian and the sorceress in the bikini outfit, and that's because that was they were making that sort of all as temp art and everything based on what they were kind of hoping the game would be, having no idea that I was off making some kind of Game of Thrones, you know, very serious cat, high fantasy world. But I did, and I was off, and I had no idea that it would be that this was going to be the world, because you know, the way James had sort of talked about it, I was just sort of taking a stab at it, and I figured that was sort of going to be a first draft, and we would go from there. But I mean, it ended up that James and I talked a lot about various things, like we talked about things that we hated about fantasy. Things that irritated us, like the fact that, you know, in a D&D world, for instance, nobody really the fact that there are mages, people who can walk around and cast spells that make you like them, and nobody thinks of that as the date rape spell, even though every first level magic user has charm person. Like, wouldn't that make you after a while start to look at a mage, and if you liked him, wouldn't you stop and think, do I like him because I like him? Or do I like him because he casts a spell on me? How would I know? How could I tell? Wouldn't there be some level of suspicion that there were people who had these magical powers that could do anything? And now, granted, there are lots of people who have magical powers in this world, but it was sort of conversations like that about how we disliked deities that didn't require belief, and the nature of how belief impacted faith. If you had proof of the existence of gods, and they were essentially mortal in our view, because they could fight each other, they could die, what would faith be the same? And what would it be like to have actual faith in a fantasy setting where people had no proof of the divine and thus had to rely on their faith to believe in its existence? So it was conversations like that, and I think that's why after six or seven months of me writing up sort of lots and lots of notes, the first draft of the world came into being, and we more or less ran with it. I mean, there were a number of changes that were made to the setting, but James sort of took it from there, and my stupid napkin map that I drew, just sort of like, I'm not very good with maps, so it was sort of like, here, and they kind of took that as the thing, and I'm like, now that I look at that map I did, I'm like, well, but that river I made makes no geographical sense. Why did you know, the things that the you look back on, and it's like, I know how they came to be, but you wish you could go back, and I wish I could go back and tell myself, Dave, they're going to take this thing you're working on very seriously, okay? But then it was just me for a while, and then the lead writer part of it came because then I got assigned new writers. I had some of them were brand new, like I just got hired, Cheryl Chi and Mary Kirby. Jennifer Hepler was added to the team. Luke Christensen came in at one point, and you know, just it was a through process of me getting them on board with what the world was about, and I was organizing. These were all who the characters are supposed to be, and I'm working directly with James, sort of the story he has envisioned, and I'm sort of creating them. You know, he would say, "Well, I kind of want an evil horde to fight." I'm like, okay, so I created the Darkspawn, and I'm like, "You mean like this?" And yeah. But you need to be part of an organization that fights them. So I'm like, I go off and create the Grey Wardens, and you mean like this? And that's just, it was sort of back and forth. That's how that came to be, and my team sort of grew naturally.
That's so awesome, because I'm that nerd, lore nerd that has like all of the books. And I'm just like, Darkspawn. It's just really interesting to hear how everything kind of came about.
Yeah, the first draft of the world did not actually have Darkspawn. It just James was sort of he read through it all. He's like, I like it all, but I just there needs to be like an evil horde like orcs. I'm like, can they be not orcs? And he's like, yes, they can be not orcs. I'm like, okay, all right. I had this idea of making them sort of this cancer allegory. I don't even remember my exact thinking at the time, but I remember making them and I handed it over to Art. And then they came back with, okay, this is how we picture Darkspawn to look like. And I'm like, they kind of look like orcs. Wow. Amazing how that happened anyway.
Yeah. But Darkspawn are frightening.
Yeah. Well, I think a combination of we wanted the evil horde. We wanted a version of the Underdark, which sort of, combined with I wanted the dwarves to be the fallen race this time, and things like sort of various different desires from various people on the project sort of colliding at the same time.
Cool. Well,
we didn't even know that the first game would be about Darkspawn.
Oh, really?
When I made the world, I kind of seeded conflicts in various areas because I had no idea what the first story would be about. James wanted Darkspawn in the world, but not necessarily that the first game would be about fighting a blight. Because at the time, the Darkspawn were all part of the past, remember? The idea that there would be a new blight that happened was not initially part of the package. Dragons were extinct, and the Darkspawn were a thing of the past, and this was a world that was rebuilding from a very dangerous past. But it wasn't initially, and the things from long ago are coming back. That didn't come into play until much, much later.
Huh.
That does explain how the first game, the disbelief everyone feels about the Darkspawn being a thing that's happening seemed very genuine. Right.
Yeah.
So it was very well written.
I may have cribbed that a little bit from Anne McCaffrey. you ever read the Dragon Riders of Pern?
Yep.
Yeah, long time ago. And I remember thinking how much I liked the very first Dragon Rider Pern book was like there hadn't been a fall, which is that it's called Thread, if I can remember right, that falls from the sky and sort of destroys everything, and the dragons have to sort of burn it out of the sky before it hits the ground. But there hadn't been a fall in a long, long time, so people thought the danger was past, and then, oh my God, suddenly there's a fall, and all our dragons are gone, and things like that. And I remember when James sort of said, well, how about we have a new blight? And I'm like, oh, but there hasn't been a blight in so many hundreds of years. And considering they were kind of like clockwork, I think everybody would sort of believe they were gone for good. And then I remembered, oh, hey, that sort of reminds me a little bit of that book I read way back in the day. And I sort of remembered sort of the way Anne McCaffrey had sort of had people's attitudes at the time. And I think that was what I had actively in mind. I was like, okay, let's approach this as in everybody is just so fucking unready for what's about to happen, and kind of just, you know, have their buckets over their heads going, la, 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 if I just pretend hard enough, this isn't actually real. And I like that idea from a story premise.
Okay, before because I'll fall down the well into lore nerdery. but since we're talking about how things came about, you know, one of the reasons we asked you to come on the show was to talk about the IGN interview about Dorian and the process of creating him.
Right.
Because, you know, like, Dorian's such a fascinating character, and it's kind of like, I haven't seen anything really bad about him, and there's been a lot of articles and things where people have been like, oh my god, this character finally gave me empathy for gay people. I'm just like, all right, look, why this took a video game character, not a real live human, you may know, but, you know, it works. But, you know, first off, thank you for answering my tweet, because I was just like, hey, I'm going to tweet, and you answered, so yay, and here we are. but, you know, do you want to talk about the process? You know, kind of, how was Dorian kind of brought about? Because with any character, it's not like he was the final product we see in the game. It's not where he started.
Right, yeah. I think a lot of people assume that he was created as the gay character, but he really wasn't. He was the Tevinter character, because we needed one. And he initially was just someone from the North who was idealistic, that he was coming down to sort of prove that not all Tevinter people are like these Venatori, because we're getting tired of sort of villainizing the Tevinter, and we wanted to show that they had a human side. And the way we do that, the best way to do that in a BioWare game is, are through the followers, because they're sort of our ciphers for the rest of the experience. Like, we can't make a player care about an abstract thing. I'm going to care about Tevinter because somebody tells me about it. No, I have to experience it first on, and I don't care about an issue. Like, I may not care about the mages or Templars, but I have followers that care about the mages and Templars. And if I care about them, I may care about those issues. So we use them as sort of hooks to get the player interested in certain aspects of the world. So he was the Tevinter character. And I remember we were talking about him sort of being the way to sort of bring in the Tevinter side of him was to sort of have him be a little bit on the elitist side. I'm like, yeah, but that'll make him really unlikable. So let's make him see if we can walk a line between him being sort of cocky and elitist, but still be sort of accessible. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was the point at which we started talking about whether we would have romances and whether any of those romances would be for different sexualities. I mean, for Dragon Age 2, I had four characters that we kind of made bisexual because we only had four romances, and I really didn't want to revisit Dragon Age Origins that had, you know, two bisexual characters, two straight characters, which means that if you were looking for a romance with the same sex, you didn't really have any option whatsoever. You had one character you could turn to, and that seemed a little lopsided to me. And I mean, fairness in a video game is debatable. I mean, it's not about fairness necessarily as much as it is about what kind of content we can deliver. But, we made them all bisexual, but that felt kind of wrong to me too, because, you know, that was done as a compromise. And I mean, bisexuality itself is a real sexuality. It's not, you know, it doesn't exist for the convenience of people so they can romance multiple people. And we didn't try to write them from that perspective, but that's definitely the reason they were all made that way. And I didn't like that. And I was prepared to do it again just because, while I didn't feel great about that, it was better than having lopsided choices, which made it very obvious to the player, you know, who was our intended primary audience. And I think it was Mike Laidlaw who said, why don't you just put in more romances? At first we just had six, and even that was a large number, because I'm like, Mike, the romances are a huge investment in time and energy. Are you sure you want me to do six? We ended up doing eight, but at the time he was like, yeah, go for six. And I said, well, if I'm going to do six, it's going to be two and two and two, and at least just to start, right? And we can go from there, but I at least... I'm not saying that, you know, everybody has to have the same amount of choices, but I want everybody to have a choice, so a minimum of two. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, go for it. And I was like, okay. So we sat down as a team, and we'd already had these characters well underway, and I don't think we'd actually chosen them yet. I mean, the way the writing team works is that we'll start working on these characters, and we don't claim them, per se. We kind of... early on, we kind of circle our favorites like buzzards, waiting for the moment when we're going to have to make our choice. We kind of, you know, sort of subtly, because, you know, most of us are Canadian, we kind of subtly let our intentions be known so everybody can kind of back off. And as Canadians, we all respectively try to find the one that can be ours. But until that point, we're kind of working on just developing them as characters we all could potentially write, that we all find interesting. And I wasn't even actually intending to write Dorian at the time. We were working on him, And I don't think it was even me. Who was it? Maybe Patrick or Luke who suggested, said, well, because I didn't really have a good reason why he left his home other than the fact that he was an idealist, but that didn't seem really strong to any of us. Mm-hmm. And I think Patrick suggested, he said, well, why isn't he maybe gay? Because maybe that's a reason he's sort of beyond his idealism, that he has sort of a conflict with his family. I'm like, well, Tevatura isn't really homophobic per se. And he's like, well, but they have a this really strong streak of how everybody has to be perfect, and it goes beyond homophobia. It goes into this sort of a Stepford kind of everybody must present a perfect face, and anything that smacks of indecency or deviant is frowned upon because everybody has to have the perfect air, right? Mm-hmm. And so he's not perfect, but he just sort of embraces that. And I was like, you know, that puts him in a new light, which I really like. And now I think I'm going to tell you all to back off because I'm going to write him. And they said, okay. And that's how my writing Dorian came to be, because I was like, okay, this has to be my character that I write. And I think it is the rest of Dorian kind of developed there, because I sort of he's not me. I think some people, they know that I'm gay, and they assume that the experiences that Dorian has, I'm just sort of transplanting myself into him. No, of course not. I mean, I have a lot of empathy as opposed to sympathy. The empathy is because I can personally relate to a lot of the things that Dorian has felt, but I haven't been through those experiences. I don't come from a privileged background. My family has been very accepting of me, so... But there are certain aspects to that that I can completely understand. So I think the fact that I got to write him allowed me to make it more personal. I mean, I would never say that somebody had to be exactly the same sexuality as the character they're writing. If that were the case, it would be very difficult to write any gay characters or bisexual characters. And, you know, that would mean I can't write any straight characters. So, but I think it does add an extra element of authenticity when you have that opportunity to have it match up. But, you know, I'd love to get when somebody gets a chance to write a character that speaks to their personal experience, I think that's ultimately going to come across. So when I started writing, I think initially I had some trouble finding Dorian's voice, because I think I was initially making him too cocky, and he was initially unlikable. And I thought, okay, you know what? I have to find this place where he's a walking wounded kind of character that if you just turn him 45 degrees, you can see exactly the kind of pain that he's been through and the defense mechanism he puts up. But it's not a pathetic thing. I can see why you're like this, but you acknowledge that he's kind of delightful, and there's a camaraderie, and I wanted to position him as someone you know, stereotypes are difficult to talk about because they exist for a reason. You can't avoid them entirely, and everybody doesn't like seeing them. Because I think at first, my very first instinct was to make him very straight acting, just because I didn't want him to be the gay guy. Uh-huh. And I thought, you know, that's bullshit. I have some very good friends who are, you know, flamboyant, I guess you could say. And that's just who they are. And it's sort of, as I thought about what I was doing, I was like, you know, this is actually pissing me off. This has sort of been ingrained into my own psyche that I would swerve away from that kind of portrayal, as if these good friends of mine who I love dearly aren't the right type of gay for public consumption. So I was like, you know what? No, I'm going to embrace the flamboyance. And if somebody wants to sort of say that Dorian is a stereotypical character, well, they can kiss my ass. And that's the sort of attitude I went into the last version of him, which I just wrote. And as soon as I started down that line, it's like Dorian's voice was instantly in my head. And the only thing that was difficult to write was the confrontation with his father. That was quite hard to get out. I know my editor who worked on it, who's also my roommate, she kind of broke to pieces as she was reading. Then she came into my office, she said, you know what? I read Dorian, and I think you did a fantastic job. And she sort of choked up, and she walked out. And I was like, okay, all right. I think I made something that satisfies me. And I don't get that chance very often.
Yeah, that was hard for. I mean, this is just personally anecdotal. It was hard for me because I'm bisexual, and I I am not in a place, and I don't think I'll ever be in a place to, like, come out to my family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Dorian's confrontation with his father, but also the dialogue that happens when you have Cole and Dorian in the party. And the
Yes.
Yeah. The hitch in his voice. And even if you can't see him on screen, hearing that discussion and how much it's hurting him, I was just like, I put the game down. I need a minute. So you wrote that very well.
Ramon Tucarum did an excellent job. I mean, I'm fortunate that one thing Byward does is they bring the writers into the VO booth a lot for the important scenes. And I mean, I was there for him doing the father scene, and I sat down with Ramon and we talked about sort of the background to it. And he said, and it was actually, I didn't required almost no direction after that point, because he sat down and he said, I understand. And he did that entire scene in one take, as I recall. And I was just sitting there. Actually, you know, I'll admit, I was sitting in the back of the booth and I cried my eyes out listening to it. But I think that's just because he hit exactly, he understood exactly what I was going for. And I don't think if the performance had been there, because, I mean, Dorian required a certain type of note with his voice actor that could, everything that I was intending could easily have been turned 10 degrees and he would have come across as smarmy or insincere. You know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. Because you know, among the BioWare fans I have as friends, you know, one thing that I really enjoy, we talked about, was, you know, like the voice acting, because without the voice acting, you can have a great script, you can have great words, but if the voice acting isn't on point, it doesn't have the same impact.
Yeah. So that worked out for me, I think, that I got a chance to write something that meant something to me personally, mm-hmm. and I ended up with an actor who just ran with it. He had no qualms. You do get that sometimes. You have actors who are like, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this, but he embraced it, and I think it ended up being a nice pair.
Yeah, definitely. So we don't run away with this, unless there was something else you wanted to add to that.
No, that's fine.
I mean, because I will freely admit, I am that nerd that could talk about the stuff all day, and we both have, yeah. All three have stuff to do. But I think our David, my David, has the next question.
Yeah. It was mentioned in the IGN piece that you've referred to Dorian as fully gay. However, he was preceded by Steve Cortez in Mass Effect 3, who was only romanceable by a male Shepard. Was not including him something you got pushback for when the interview came out?
No. Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, there are people who will interpret things that get said however they want. And I didn't write that article. I just gave the interview. It was the writer, and then what the writer said in the article was that Dorian was the first breakout gay character,
yes.
Which some people really took issue with. And I mean, I said, some people came to me with that, and I'm like, hey, I did not say he was the first breakout gay character. The author felt that way, and maybe you should ask him why he feels that. And he never even said that Dorian was the first gay character, because of course he was not, and neither was Steve. The first gay character we ever did with BioWare was Juhani, which I think actually he did say in the article that it was Juhani. But Steve was the first male gay character, absolutely, yes. Oh, yes. There wasn't a gay male character in KOTOR. The first gay male Juhani? Romance you could have was Sky from Jade Empire.
Oh, yeah.
But he was bisexual, so the first male gay character was Steve. I did get some flack for the fully gay thing. That was actually earlier, back when we first revealed that Dorian was gay. It was in an interview that just by word, you know, the community people came up and they asked me a bunch of questions about him, sort of, so they could present it as here's what Dorian is about. And of the 10 questions, the last one was is there anything else you'd like to add about Dorian? I said, yeah, I just would like to add that Dorian was my first chance to write a fully gay character, and I really appreciated that. Which, of course, it spiraled out, because on one hand, you had the people who, like, the fact that, that one of those questions was me mentioning that he was gay meant that basically BioWare had held a press release to announce that we had a gay character, and you had all the guys who just would lose their mind over, oh, you have to announce he's gay? Like, you have to sort of throw it in our faces and doing that? Actually, well, the phrase they use is you have to shove it down our throats, which I find hilarious, just the analogy. But then you had there was the other side of that was people that objected to me saying the phrase fully gay, which you have to throw it in quotes, which sort of implied that the previous characters were half gay. And thus, people who are bisexual are only half gay. And I was like, ugh. At this point, I was just, I regret it only because that there's really no way I could have won. Because what I was thinking at the time was, without me specifying that he was fully gay, there was a whole group of people that would have said, well, you've written lots of gay characters. No, I've written lots of bisexual characters. I've never actually written a gay character, but... the people that are listening for that said, well, we didn't need to say fully gay. You could have just said gay. Yes, that would have made you happy, and these other people would not have understood. So really, I was in a lose-lose situation. I certainly didn't intend. You know, I guess I could have said totally gay. I sort of, you know, these are phrases I use in real life. I don't know, but obviously bisexual erasure is a real thing, and I understand exactly why they feel like they do, but... There was some serious word policing which went on there, and I was like, yeah, I get it. I'm sorry. I didn't intend that. But it's out there, so really what can you do, right?
Oh, believe me, I know. I had to learn the hard way and remind myself not to read comments on anything I publish. Yeah, that was not a fun... My last Pace article was not a fun day, so...
Yeah, there's... I have the misfortune of getting it from both sides, and both of them are equally unsympathetic of the fact that I have to do that, which is fine. That's just part of my life. It kind of disappoints me sometimes that the amount of vehemence I guess I get from some parts of the social justice crowd. I won't say all, because it is just a part of them that just sort of, they seem to be angrier with people who only mostly agree with them as opposed to the ones that don't agree with them at all. I don't really know what to do with that, but all I can do is sort of tell myself I get where the anger comes from. Believe me, you know, it's not like I don't have any sympathy, but I just at some point I have to say, well, you know what, I only 95% agree with you. I'm sorry, and if that makes you really upset, then so be it.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is.
It is, you know, and that's not going to be good enough either. Just my saying that, I'm sure there will be angry posts somewhere, you know, saying fuck him, fuck him, fuck him in his hat. Well, he is the devil. I've had people call me a monster. I've been called biphobic, transphobic. Oh, what else? Oh, I hate dwarves, as in real little people. And like, no, dwarves, fantasy dwarves. They're not little people. They're not the same thing. But whatever. I hate them clearly because I'm the reason that there were no dwarf romances to date, and that apparently is some crime against humanity. I don't even know. I can't even keep track of it anymore. But that is just something I will deal with because that comes with the territory. It gets a little wearing when you get that, and you get the other side. I get the Gamergate trolls, of course, or who knows how many other types there are now. That have to fly at me, you know, the fact that Dorian existed. It's like that. I love the part where, I'm sorry, I'm going up on a rant here.
Oh, it's fine.
I apologize in advance, but the part where it's like, well, you have to stand on a soapbox and make a gay character. The ones that assume that creators' hands are tied, that they're fighting for our creative freedom, that left to our own devices, if we weren't, you know, frightened of the... of the social justice crowd, which of course we obviously are, because anybody who yells at us, we just immediately kowtow because we're frightened of what they'll do. If that were true, why wouldn't we listen to them? They think of that? No. But that we have to, left our own devices, we would just make, you know, tits and ass all day long and nothing else. And there's nothing about what we want that's in these changes that we're making. Other than the fact that, you know, someone like me, who clearly holds the rest of the team to some kind of gun, right? Like, I'm just telling everybody else, hey, all of you, gay people now, and they're like, oh shit, I guess we better do it. Like, is that, I can really picture it. But
Canada, do you have guns in Canada?
No, we don't have guns in Canada. I guess I would be threatening them with a snowball. I don't even know. they say, well, you know, it shouldn't be forced, this kind of diversity thing. It should just happen naturally. And like, what is this? There's this naturally. What is it that you picture? Because as near as I can tell, any kind of minority, whether it's like a black person who appears or a gay person who happens to at some point say that they're gay and actually mention it, is suddenly in their face and being shoved down their throat. And, oh, God, it just jumped out of me as jarring. Suddenly I'm not even playing a game anymore. So what is this natural diversity that you're talking about? Is it that these characters can never be seen, never actually mention that they're diverse, maybe in a codex somewhere, I guess? Like, it should be invisible, and I guess maybe at some point you might see them holding hands, although that could be a slap in the face too. Like, what kind of diversity are they talking about? What are they picturing? And why are we not allowed to invite? Because if we do put it in, we're certainly not allowed to actually invite people who might be interested in that kind of content to the table. So we're certainly not supposed to announce it or tell anybody that this is in the game. It's just sort of supposed to be kept stealth because they would just prefer that they continue to pretend that people aren't interested in other types of representation, I guess. I don't know. That's the end of my rant. I'm sorry. It's a little hot button reaction for me.
Oh, no, don't apologize. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but if you've seen the hashtag #IneedDiverseGames, that was me.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
So I'm just nodding my head. You can't see me, and the audience can't see me, but I'm just like, yeah, I totally get it.
Yeah, nobody listens to what I have to say, really, anyway. I mean, at this point, they just assume that anybody in the industry who says that they support it, they're either brainwashed by feminists, of course, and so thus not telling the truth. Or might, like me, they're already gay, and we're just sort of the cancer inside the industry, sort of diverting it from its true noble purpose, I guess. As if that was the primary thing I did all along, was think about how to get more gay people into the game, as if I don't have anything else to do. Like a plot.
Or, you know, write character's life story or something like
or,
that.
Or 750,000 words of dialogue, yeah.
Yeah. People are interesting.
it's their focus, whether it's negative or positive. It is an entirety of their focus. Some of them have way too much time on their hands, but who am I to judge? I mean, I have work to do, and they have what they do.
Yeah, because I understand, because I think as of today I'm blocking over 100,000 people on Twitter.
Wow, 100,000.
Block lists are a magical thing.
Wow. How do you even block them? You didn't do them one at a time.
Oh God, no.
are there lists?
Yes, there are lists. I will send you my block list if you would like it.
Oh, that's okay. I actually don't block many people. I have a pretty thick skin. The only time it's a rare person to sort of get under my skin, and God forbid that I ever show some emotion and get annoyed with somebody. Oh my God. But it happens sometimes. But most of the time, I see somebody do that, and thank God for the mute button, because you should see if you actually block someone sometimes. I've had people who I've blocked for damn good reasons who will run to other people and they get them to come at me and whine, like, why did you block this person? Like, I'm sorry, do they have some constitutional right to see my tweets and have me see theirs? You know, fuck them. It's my Twitter.
Yeah, and I mean, we can talk about this more once we're done recording. But there's been a lot of talk about block lists, because Randy Harper's GG Autoblocker block together lists, because I was a very small fish on Twitter until IneedDiverse Games really kind of went wild and grew up on its own. Because a friend of mine called me and she was like, so that hashtag is trending. I don't care what you're doing. Get all these block lists right now. And if I didn't have those block lists, I probably couldn't be on Twitter.
I don't know. I don't get a lot. I mean, let's face it, as a guy, as a white guy, mm-hmm. never mind the fact that I'm gay, as a white guy, I can talk about issues or say things that if I wasn't a white guy or guy, I would be lambasted for. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Like everybody assumes, oh, you must have gotten a lot of hate for that. I got some, but I'm positive. I mean, in fact, I am absolutely certain that it's nowhere what it would have been had I been anybody other than who I am. Like look at what happened to Jen Hepler, who used to work with us. I mean, her offense compared to some of the things that I've said to people, you know, comparatively minor. It was completely infuriating. I remember when it happened. I was so angry. It made me physically ill.
And that was bullshit. And, you know, if you ever talk to her, I'm sure you still talk to her, tell her her fans miss her.
I haven't spoken to her in a while, actually. She moved out of the country. And the last, we occasionally I'll exchange messages on Twitter, but I haven't actually spoken to her in a while.
Aww. Well, I'm glad she's still in the industry, even if she is not at BioWare.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, speaking of writing, we actually did have a couple more questions, but you know,
sure, yeah.
No, this is, I like it when this happens because it means the conversation is just really, really awesome. And, you know, I'm glad that you feel safe enough to vent with us. But no, we were talking about writing and I mentioned earlier about there's a lot of people, especially straight guys, are like, oh my God, I finally get it. I understand empathy and, you know, I romance someone with this character and I get it. You know, on the one hand, that's cool. But, you know, as the person who wrote Dorian and as someone in the gay community, how does that affect you? Or is that kind of like, oh, that's cool. You found some empathy, but whatever.
I am completely positive about it. I mean, I'm surprised that there are that many guys who are willing to admit it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I always thought that if anybody ever did that, they would kind of like, you know, not really talk about it. But there's been a lot of cases, surprisingly a lot, of people who said, yeah, no, I romanced Dorian and it was awesome. And even though I'm straight and he was just great, I'm in love with him. And I'm like, are you a unicorn? I don't know how to respond to that. But the fact that they did that, I mean, I've never seen anybody say it gave me empathy for gay people. I haven't seen that. If so, cool. I mean, I guess in some ways it's a very safe way to explore what that might be like for somebody. It's the kind of thing that they would never be able to do any other time because a real person involves all sorts of risks that a video game character does not.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to being a guy, there's a certain brittleness to masculinity, I don't really know how to describe it. It's brittle enough that guys will go out of their way usually to avoid any kind of sense of risk when it comes to appearing as anything else. But in this case, you have a video game character that's like, well, if there's any part of you that is open-minded and sort of willing to go, well, you know, what would this be like? And sort of to go through it and say, hey, you know, he was kind of cool. And the romance wasn't as different from a regular romance as I would have thought. And that's kind of neat. I never thought about it in that light. If somebody comes to me and says that you know, I'm totally straight. And I just wanted to tell you that you kind of opened my eyes about Dorian and about gay men. And it was sort of neat. And thank you. I take that as a giant compliment. I don't know how else I would take that.
Well, it is pretty cool. I brought it up because there was someone who actually did a YouTube video about it. And I'll see if I can find the link.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
I'd like to see that.
I will find you a link and send it to you once we are done recording. Because if I type now, it sounds like a herd of elephants on this mic.
Oh, fair enough.
But as our in-house editor, I will give David Reeves the next question.
Yeah, this is a very simple question, apparently. Well, for me, it's simple to say. The answer may be more complicated. What is life at BioWare like as a writer?
It seems
like you've touched on this. Yeah, what is life like at BioWare as a writer?
Well, you come in, and I mean, at the beginning of the week, I generally will be directing people as to what their tasks for the week are. When we get into like full production, it's a daily thing where you talk about, okay, what are we working on today? And everybody would tell me, well, I'm working on this particular file. Or even though right now we're in pre-production for our project, so it'd be like, all right, so I'm working on this section of the world. I'm adding details, so I'll be touching base. And they might have a problem, so they'll sort of rope the group into a brainstorm, and we're sitting around a room trying to talk through this issue. Because generally it's something like, well, I had this thing written, and there's this logical problem, and now I don't know what to do about it. Do you guys have any thoughts? And we'll spend about 10 to 20 minutes joking our asses off, because that's what we do. Hey, give me a horn. And like, no, okay, seriously, guys. And like, all right. And then we'll get down to business. And we'll just sort of talk through the issue, or they'll have finished up something, and they're going to present it to the group. If it is a peer review, at least we sit down, we'll each have to read the section ourselves, and then we come to the meeting, and we have a particular peer review process that we go through, where we sort of brutalize it in a civilized fashion. But otherwise, if we're doing actual writing, it is just a lot of clacking on keyboards. The room's very quiet. We try not to bother each other. We drink a lot of coffee. And I will generally be hijacking the group to discuss, because as the lead writer, I'll be getting things to review constantly, right? And say I notice, okay, I'm seeing that we're having a lot of divergence in how people are writing the main character's voice. Let's talk about how to sort of bring that all into line with each other. Or I see nobody's using the special options that we provide for the player. Can we talk about making a quota for exactly how many for each plot we should aim for? If not, I hate being very prescriptive with the mechanics like that. I find it makes the experience very mechanical for the player. So I try to, at least like the, when it came to the romances for Inquisition, for instance, I refused to say every romance had to work like X. That's why, you know, like not every romance ends in marriage. That's why not every romance sort of proceeds the same way. Some of them have sex in the middle, some of them have sex in the end, some of them don't have sex at all. I mean, when I wrote Dorian, you don't have to have sex with him and the romance can continue. I wanted to do that. I think we should do more of that. Just sort of things like that. There's lots. It's never really the same, although we can go through periods where we're just working on this one particular aspect. But even then, the exact thing you're working on from day to day will change. There's lots of meetings. We have to collaborate a lot. And what that just means is that we have to sit down with other teams and go over something. If this one team is working on a new monster, we want to sit down with them and say, okay, what kind of backstory do you want for this monster? Does it fit into the IP? I noticed that you wanted it to... I had this issue in Dragon Age a lot. Oh, you noticed this new creature you have, what you wanted it to teleport. They're like, yeah. I'm like, well, I hate to remind you for the 15th time, but teleportation does not exist in the setting. It's like, man, could you make this one exception? Like, well, is the gameplay effect you're looking for getting the creature from one point of the map to the other really quickly? Yes. Like, well, could you design the visual effects so that it has like a blur behind them so it just looks like they're moving really fast? Yeah. I'm like, okay, then not teleportation. You haven't broken the IP. And they're like, oh, okay. So we kind of have to work together like that, just try to not step on each other's toes too much. And when we can get something going together, I mean, you know what? We have our cinematics people that we spend a lot of time with. It's like I'll have a cinematics person come and work on one of my arcs. And they'll sit down with me and we'll talk about... I remember when I wrote Fenris for DA2, Sarah Hayward, one of our cinematics people, she was really excited to work on him, on his romance. And she's like, well, how do you imagine him? And I was sort of like, well, you know, I just kind of picture him. He sort of never looks at you like straight eye to eye. His hair always kind of hangs half in front of his face. So he's kind of looking at you from just under his hair. And she's like, oh, she got really excited. Like, and we were kind of mimicking it and playing it out. And I kind of had to sort of demonstrate how I thought the sort of the romance scene would go, where he pushes you. No, sorry, I'm not pushing her against the wall. I'm just sort of showing exactly how I thought it would go. She got very animated. So if somebody watching, they would have said, what are you guys even doing? Like, are you doing a role play thing over there? And like, oh yeah, no. But that's sort of sometimes how it goes. Like, we're talking about how to present story, right? And it's neat working with other people, because I think when I've worked on novels, and I find that a very solitary experience that I enjoy for different reasons. But that when you get to work with someone and you can collaborate with them, like I'm talking to Sarah, for instance, and I can tell she approaches the story from a very visual side, which as a writer I don't often think about, because, and then she'll point out things like, it's like, well, you got this whole segment here, and I can't think about what is going on visually here. It just seems like, you know, talking heads would be all that's involved. I'm like, yeah, you know, I never thought about it like that. And then here's this other section where it's very easy to imagine that this is something that Fenris is walking around sort of waving his bottle of wine angrily, and that was very easy for her to visualize, and sort of trying to approach it from a different aspect. Or we're talking to an artist, and they're like, well, I want to put this ribbon around his arm or something, and the sort of to signify his affection. Would that be cool? And I'm like, actually, I so seldom think about details of their appearance in that way. I think about in terms of how visual elements can express parts of their character without me having to talk about it. You know what I mean? Like even in a novel, if there was an element and I wanted it to be meaningful, I'd have to write it, right? But trying to get more towards the letting artists and cinematics people and voice actors tell more of the story and sort of take some of that power away from me. And I mean, for me being willing to surrender, it's like being willing to write a line that says, instead of me writing that I am sad, to just write the line and have the voice actor say it sadly and trust that that sadness will be communicated in the way that I like. That's a sort of surrender of writer power there, because I'm turning it over to the voice actor and I say, all right, so this part with Dorian, he's actually saying that he hates the character and he wishes he would go away and never come away, but he means the exact opposite. Do you understand that? That it's him, it's his unwillingness to be schmaltzy and appear romantic, but it's his way of saying I love you without saying I love you. Can you impart that? And he's like, yeah, totally get it. And then he does it. And it's like, okay. Because it's as a writer, you want to have all of that. You want to say what they're feeling and say what they're doing and show it. Tell it all, and you have to sort of showing it involves a certain amount of surrender, which can be quite stressful.
Yeah, because you know when you're talking about Fenris, I never had the heart to do it, and I will never do it. But I did watch a video of someone giving him back to Daenerys, and the way like I can't, I just can't.
I shouldn't laugh. I don't even remember how that went in. I think that was Jennifer's idea.
I take back the.
I'll throw her under the bus. I think she brought it up. She brought it up one day, I think, and I laughed and laughed and laughed, especially when she wrote Anders gave an approval jump if you did that. I'm like, oh, that's so rude, Jennifer. How could you have him? He's like, well, she's like, well, she doesn't like Fenris. Fuck him. Oh man, brutal. And I loved it, so I kept it. So whatever.
Well, I take back the nice things I said about him.
Oh no. People think I'm the evil one on the team. Not even Jennifer. No. You want the most evil writer on our team? Mary Kirby. Yeah. She wrote Eric. She wrote Vivienne. She don't give her a knife, man, because she will happily cut you up. I sometimes have to rein her in. I'm like, how can you do this? That's brutal. She's like, meh. You know, they deserve it. I'm like, wow. I'm just cringy right here in empathy. But I don't have a lot of empathy. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in the position I am. So it's okay.
Oh, my God. I'm sort of glad you can't see the look on my face. It's just this, like stricken expression. I forgot my thought. So it's like that crestfallen look he gets, one when Varenya betrays him. And before he turns away from Hawk, especially if the Hawk is romanced, I was like, you know, just the expression, whoever animated his face deserves an award.
That's Sarah, yeah. I love how she made it when he goes. She just has him sort of slump, like he's just given up.
Yeah.
And when I saw that scene and she'd done that, I'm like, oh my God, Sarah, that is perfect, actually. Because Sarah's just like Mary. She just said, you know, I'll just think I'm like, even though David didn't write him doing anything here, I thought it would just fade to black. I'm going to have him walk off with his shoulders slumped. Like, I guess I'm going back to the life I deserve. And I'm like, Sarah, you just sort of stabbed the knife into the person who just did that. And she's like, well, if they took that decision, they really deserve it, don't they? I'm like, oh, okay, fair. Okay, fair.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. As many times as I've played the game, I just could never make that choice. I did let Bull sacrifice the Chargers once. Then I apologized on stream and replayed it. So since we're talking about all the things in games and stuff that have come up, you know, now that you know Inquisition's done, Trespasser's out. If you could change anything, like if you could go back and like Mike said, here, you get one or two things you can change about the series, what would that be?
About the entire series?
The entire series, or pick a game. Your choice.
Mm. Well, I wish we had more time to work on Dragon Age 2. There's a lot of things I think I really enjoyed about Dragon Age 2 as a game. And I just wish we'd had a little bit more time to polish it, because I think it had a lot of potential. I mean, the fact that I remember when the time jumps, when the fact that the city was supposed to change between each jump originally, and then outfits supposed to change, and that got cut out of necessity. And I'm just like, it would have been little things like that I think would have had a better reception, because I think it deserved a better reception than they got, just by virtue of what we tried to do. And I mean, I totally understand. It is what it is, right? But I think that there was a lot of stuff about Dragon Age 2 that was really strong. So I sometimes feel, you know, the shoulda, woulda, coulda regarding that. As for other stuff, I don't know. It's hard because there's so many things along the way, things we cut, things that I fully understand the reasons for them. And I can't in good conscience say I wish we would have done that differently, because I know why it was done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, for me, that's going off into a fairy Neverland that I know doesn't exist. I'm too much of a realist when it comes to that. I can't really acknowledge the shoulda, wouldas, or it's like a rabbit hole that's down that hole lies madness, right? And I don't know. What would I change? I probably, if I had my druthers, I would have gone back and had no carryover of plot states between games.
Really?
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if we'd never done it, nobody would have expected us to. I think that story-wise, that shot ourselves in the foot. I know some people really like it or really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. But I think that ultimately it fails to deliver the promise that is made when you do carry over that state, which is completely divergent story, which we can't actually provide. But I think that when people hear that their plot states are carried over, what they first imagine is something that we can't provide, and thus often, depending on how their expectations lie, often we're inevitably disappointing them. So either they don't care or they're disappointed. I think it's kind of a lose-lose. But that's just me personally as a thinking about it kind of thing. That's not, since I don't get to decide that, it's not as if you could say, oh, David Gator says that from now on. No, I have no idea what we'll do from now on. That's made at a higher level than me. But I think that is a troublesome thing to promise. And I think that's why most games just do not do it. If you notice, most games that are a series, new game, will either take place in a completely different place or time completely, or even if they did recognize their own decisions, they really would be irrelevant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why a lot of... Except which, sorry?
I was going to say, except for Mass Effect, I can't think of other games that do that.
Yeah, we're the games that just sort of dove right into that, right? So most other games, no, it's amnesia or nothing, right?
Yeah.
There's those Telltale games, but the way they're made, they seem to devote all of their resources into tackling the problem of divergent storylines.
Yes, well, hey, you're right there, actually. Telltale does do a lot of stuff similar to the way we do, and that is you have to be very careful about what you carry over, right? And you'll notice that they do a lot of what we do, which is, I call it a bottleneck. You make two choices, they diverge for a bit, but eventually it all goes back to the same plot line, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Which it has to, because you can't do anything else. But for us, of course, we have these sort of widespread arcs. It's like did Morrigan have a child, an old god baby, or not? Then some people go, well, if she did, clearly that's the center of the entire plot from that point on. It will change the entire world. I'm like,
actually, no.
Actually, no. But you know, we do what we can. I think we actually did a pretty good job. It just the amount of effort it took. Deceptive. Because you'll only ever in your playthrough see one small side of that. And if there are people who really do enjoy it, I wish they would speak up more, because it would be nice to know if there are people out there who really like that. Because the impression I get is that for most people, they think that there's very little reactivity, when in fact having been one of the people that went in and sort of had to put a lot of that reactivity in, it was everywhere. And as each game goes by, it sort of gets exponential. So I remember watching the Mass Effect 3 guys with their array of all the divergents that they had to create content for, and I was like, oh my god, what a nightmare. And they're like, yeah, you guys have no idea. I'm like, oh, I will. I'm up next with the DAI. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry, man. Yeah, we do actually talk like that.
It's how people talk every day at work.
Yeah, you just got these bags under your eyes, if you can imagine, just bloodshot. It's like, man, have you guys been crunching for, what, 3 months now? Yeah. Oh, wow. It kind of makes those forum posts where people say, well, can't you just write a little bit more? You kind of just want to reach to the monitor and slap them. No, I can't. Shut up.
Sorry. Jamie,
I was thinking about Dragon Age 2, and one of the things about it that I found really interesting was that there are parts where it absolutely takes away your choices. And I feel like since it's set up to give you, you know, with the importing save states, those hit quite a bit harder.
Yeah. I mean, some of it wasn't intentional. Like, I remember I actually had planned for the ending of DA2 to have complete divergence based on whether you sided with the mages or Templars. But one of the end battle was supposed to have two completely different versions, and one of them got cut, and I was like, oh. Sometimes you just gotta roll with the punches, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I wonder how I had a moment of, I wonder what that would have meant for DAI, but oh well.
Oh, you know, we just would have, I mean, some of it we do intentionally, just because it's like, we'll look at a choice of maybe we'll do this, and I'm like, okay, is future Dave going to be really angry at you for this? And I'm like, yeah, I better be nicer to future Dave and not set myself up. Right? Like, so you got to try to limit the damage, limit the promises you make for the knowing that you'll have to sort of be the person who manages that in the future. So that is an issue. And sometimes the things that they end up having forced into is like, well, that everybody says, well, why would you have written it that way? Well, it's like, I didn't intend it to be that way. The first draft always looks a lot different than the last draft. That's because we go through a long process, and it's not like it gets, you know, I don't want the impression to be that, oh, it just starts off awesome and then gets suck. No. It, a lot of things get better as other people start adding things into it, but it's not always, we can't always approach it from the fact that what would that make the best story? I mean, I think ideally, sure. However, we are also making a game, and it's a game where, you know, if I write, yeah, and they suddenly teleport into Antiva City for all of 5 minutes of game time. Hey, Art, can you spend the next 6 months making a set piece for Antiva, make it look really awesome, just so I can get the player there for 5 minutes? They'll be like, no. Oh, really? Yeah. Like, I mean, it is a process where you have to work together, and we have to actually model everything the player sees, and we have to have game systems, and there's a certain amount of content. And I mean, if we didn't limit ourselves to what we were putting out there, it would never get made. It would just sort of eventually everything would fall apart as we sort of scoped out of control. That is, we just have to inherently limit ourselves, and I'm try to keep the overall scope of the story small enough that we're working within the space we can, but still make it broad enough that the player feels like they have agency. Agency is important as opposed to actual choice. The player has to feel like they're more in control of their destiny than they actually are, which is not at all.
Well, yeah, the game is going to do what the game's going to do.
Absolutely.
Free will is an illusion. Gotcha.
Yeah, well, it's a shell game is what it is. Right? I am the one who's looking at the player, and I'm moving the things around like, ah? One cat. Colin? You know, shuffle, pull up another one. Hey, Dorian? You know, that's me in a nutshell.
Yeah, I've got that image.
I don't even know what I just said, to be honest.
Are you talking about the shell game? And I'm just thinking about...
The shell game?
Well, because, like, I still see people trying to do the shell game here, and I'm just like, who falls for this?
Where are you?
I'm in Chicago.
Oh, okay, all right. Is that a thing?
It's like a thing. Yep.
Oh, God. Every time I go to New Orleans, somebody always has to come up to me and says, I bet you you can't, what is it? I forget now. Damn it. Never mind. Move on.
You'll remember when we're done.
Ah, yeah. Right after we're done, I'll be like, oh, now I remember.
I believe David Reeves has the next question.
Yes. And that question is, as a dev and as a gamer, what do you think the industry is doing right now, or doing diversity-wise, that could be improved?
I mean, there's a lot of room for improvement. I think that really goes without saying. Do I really have to belabor that? I mean, there's a few companies that are trying. I mean, according to some people, like, I think sometimes the fact that BioWare does anything at all kind of paints a target on us from all sides. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like that there are people that care more about the things that we get wrong than the things that we do right, which is frustrating. But it's like that doesn't matter ultimately, because we're doing it, A, because it makes for more interesting characters. Like, I mean, some people just assume, well, you're doing it just for social justice reasons. No, I think having the same white, brown-haired, you know, really short-haired protagonist over and over and over again in everything we see is boring. I think having, you know, every character be straight I think that's just dull. I think that this is the fact that we're freed. It's incredible that some people consider it to be creative shackling. I think that we're freed, that now there's more willingness to add in these different types of characters. I think that opens up so many different possibilities. It would be nice to see more companies do that, yeah, but I think the way that the industry inevitably works is it's a bit of a copycat situation. They're looking to see what everybody else, to take the first risk, because we're talking about games that cost hundreds of millions of dollars to make, essentially. And for the people that have to spend that money, as opposed to the people who spend, you know, $50 to buy it, they're taking a hell of a risk. So it's hard to ask them, say, hey, you know what, you should take all these financial risks just because it's a good idea. And some people, thankfully, will say, you know what, you're right. But to expect that all of them would feel that way, that's just not going to happen. It's not realistic. But the fact that there are some that are doing it and we're not suffering for it, I think it's showing more companies that this is a thing that they can do. And so there's more creators that are going, hey, you mean I can have a wider diversity of characters? That's awesome. I think the next step would be having more diverse people making the games. Mm-hmm. Having more diversity within the teams themselves, and not just in the writers. There aren't a lot of writers, to be honest. I mean, amongst programmers and designers and producers, or, you know, executive producers, the people who actually call the decisions on the games. And I think that's happening. So we're in sort of a transition. And I know the guys that, well, it should just happen naturally. No, it's not going to happen naturally. When has diversity ever happened naturally? It has to happen deliberately. It has to be a conscious choice, because the unconscious choice, and there's no maliciousness in it. The unconscious choice, if you just don't think about it, is just to do, like, suddenly everybody you've hired is a white guy, right? Straight white guy. And you're like, well, I didn't, you know, I don't know why you're criticizing for me. I didn't think about it. While that in itself is worthy of some criticism, the only way it happens is through deliberate action. And now, does that have to mean that the end result is that everything is applied to some sort of mechanical formula? Okay, so I have 40 characters. Let's say I have 10% is 20. No, nobody. But I don't think that's a straw man, because nobody's suggesting there should be that either. I just think that if there was sort of broader representation across all games a little bit, nobody would be trying to focus on the few games that do anything, right? Because I think, I know, and I'm not suggesting that what BioWare does is perfect. We make a lot of mistakes. We misstep. We put our feet, you know, we can put our foot so far out in our mouths that it comes out of our ass. You know, that happens. But I mean, we're trying, and we're trying to take those steps, and we're trying to listen and not get too defensive when people sort of fly at us, and they fly at us because here's a game that actually is trying. So they want to be perfect. They want every type of representation. It's like, well, how can I possibly represent the entire breadth of humanity in one game? I can't. And it's sad that I can't, but I can't. Could I do more? Sure. But does the responsibility all fall only on us? No. There's the rest of the industry that has to come along as well. And as I said earlier, I do see that happening, which is nice. And I just see a lot more games that are taking those things and getting recognized for it, although, God forbid, the media actually write an article about it, you know. But it's happening regardless of what the certain segments would have to say about it. Things are changing. you get people all the time in the industry. Like I've given presentations and had people come up after and said, you know what, I've been on this team and I never really thought about this issue before. And you're right. It is something that we have to consider. And the last time I gave a talk on it, I'm like, you know, the people can accuse us of whatever they want. The other guys who are like, oh, so all you do all day is think about, you know, romance isn't gay. Like, no, that's a really small part of my job. Even my writing, the romances in writing, I would say, 5% actually deals with romance. And as far as time goes, the time we spent deciding these things, very small. But, I mean, at various points, never mind just about romance, it's about having a point where we're looking at the characters we put into a level. Like, it's something that it comes from the writers. Sometimes the last one was Caroline Livingston, our VO director. She came to us and said, so I was looking at the cast list that we downloaded from the editor as to all the various Templars and warriors you got in the game. And they're all guys. Like, could, you know, just so I can, you know, get a few more actresses in here, can we make some of them women? And I'm like, yeah. And, you know, I went to the team and everybody had the same response. They're like, oh, you know what? I hadn't even thought about that. I just had assigned the character warrior one to them and didn't even consider it. I just thought, and everybody thought the same thing. So that's how that sort of thing just happens. We never actually stop to consider it. So it requires a deliberate, oh, maybe we should make a warrior two and make that one female and use that in various places so that we have a little bit more spread. You know, that's all it takes is to stop occasionally, doesn't take all day, and ask the question, could it be something else? That's all. Don't slap anybody in the face with it. It's just stopping and wondering if something other than just the default is even a possible thing. And the answer inevitably is yes, and followed by, huh, I didn't even think about that. And that's pretty much how the industry operates.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know if you read a thing I actually read about Dragon Age and that very issue of, you know, kind of going through all three games, looking at the diversity or lack thereof in it. And it was just like, you know, I made a point of saying that it's not done out of malicious or racist intent. It's just there's some things that come up that maybe no one on the team would think of because you don't have X life experience. You know?
Yeah, basically. And then it's very easy for if they get called on that to get very defensive. I mean, even as somebody who does think about this stuff occasionally, even though I don't get to do everything I want, it's like somebody says to me, well, why weren't there more black people on the team? It's like, well, in the game. And I'm like, well, I control what people say. There's another team that controls what people, how they look. So I can't control it. I mean, they're going to talk to me regardless because I'm representative of my company. And I'm not going to throw someone under the bus and say, nope, not my fault. Get away. It's like, no, we are at fault for what we present, but it's like, it's a collective thing. And I mean, I'm lucky that it has spread throughout the team. I'll see a lot more artists, for instance, actually talking about that now and having like the lead artist stop occasionally and say, okay, these look great. Let's have a few more examples or doing little things like some of the concepts we got recently. They were just showing the armor, like what our base armors would look like. But the character they used was a black guy. Just as that's not an actual character in the game. Just use somebody that isn't the default, just sort of to keep that in the back of everyone's head, you know? Just to throw it out there. And just having people that are more on board with that is great. Because, I mean, if nobody at all asked the question, because they that's just not part of their experience, like, you can't blame them. But if you have nobody on your team at all, and you don't pay any attention to the questions that are being asked around you, then you can't really claim to be surprised by the reaction afterwards.
Yeah, because one thing that, you know, and I will tell on myself, is that one character I had a very visceral reaction to was Mother Giselle. And, you know, I got a lot of flack for what I said about her because I saw her as a trope of the hyper-religious black woman.
Oh, okay.
And I actually had a really good conversation with Karen Weeks about it. But people are like, no, you're wrong. And it's like, I'm a black person who grew up in the U.S. and has experience with this trope being applied to me erroneously. So, right. You know, you, there's a lot of, well, you're just, you know, projecting. It's like, well, what else am I going to project? This is my life experience. So it's, I just find that interesting when people get very caught up in a character, and it's just like, if you don't agree with the way I see this character or the take I had on them, then you're wrong. You're, or like you said, you're inserting this social justice bullshit.
Right.
And I'm like, no, this is just how I read the character. You know, and I was happy to find out, you know, that wasn't the intent. But again, it was just how I took it.
No, that's fair. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't know if you're aware, we had a character called Serendipity in Dragon Age 2, for instance.
Yes.
That we did not intend to be transgender. Mm-hmm. We'd intended for her to be a drag queen, sort of a very over-the-top flamboyant drag queen, very sarcastic, and we loved her when we wrote her, and they didn't have time to give her the kind of appearance that we wanted, so they just gave her a female appearance.
Okay.
And we're like, oh, okay. And someone pointed out on our forums afterwards and said, you know, I saw this character as transgender. I mean, I would never say, I would never want it to be like, oh, well, we intended for her to be a drag queen, so your opinion, your interpretation is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. There's a, you gotta put a little bit of a death of the author in there, right? This is, we put it out there, people are going to interpret it, and, you know, some interpretations require more of a journey than others. Yes, it's true. But to say that somebody's interpretation is wrong, it's like, well, but you should expect when you put it out there that it is going to be interpreted. So to say, okay, this person had, said, I saw this character as transgender, and it felt like a really shitty trope to me, because it seems like every time you put a transgender character in the game, they're a sex worker, and used for laughs. And said, rather earnestly, is there any chance that you could make a transgender character that wasn't a sex worker or wasn't there for comedic effect? Would that be possible? And this person, of course, on our forums got jumped on. And I remember it was Mary Kirby who wrote Serendipity, who sort of interjected and said, hey, guys, lay off. I just want you to know that I did not intend that. There was actually a bug that caused a line to be skipped that made it the sort of people look, were reacting in DA2 to Serendipity. I forget what it exactly was, but it made it look bad. She explained, no, that was a bug. I didn't intend that. And I didn't intend for it to appear the way you're attending, but I understand why you feel as you did. I just want you to know that I didn't mean that, and I agree that we can do better, and I think I hear you. And that's really all she said, and of course, nobody really left this person alone. I really have no idea how the person felt about it afterwards. I don't think they ever came back to the forum, but I didn't really appreciate the fact that they took the time to tell us, and I felt bad about it, because it's like, that's not what we intended, and I feel bad that it could be interpreted that way. And I mean, I can't, to a point, I can't actually avoid that. There are always going to be interpretations that are like, wow, I don't even know how you made that journey. But I would never say, no, that's wrong. I can only say what we intended, and I can say, well, hopefully we can do something better in the future. And that's not always going to be the case. I could not promise this person, yes, you're right, We will totally include a different type of transgender character in the next game. Absolutely. Like, no, I don't control that. So I cannot make such a promise. But to let them know that they heard, and it's worth thinking about. Because it's like, what we've always tried to do is include different types of characters. It's like, whenever we have romances, for instance, everybody always seems to run on the assumption that we'll have exactly the same kind of romances we had last time. It's like, well, okay. I get that you think Cassandra isn't the buxom hot chick that you were kind of hoping for. Got it. They're like, well, you know, I really liked Morgan. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if you've been paying attention to the romances we've done from game to game, but we almost never repeat type. Look at the various female character romances we've had between Dragon Age Origins, Dragon Age 2, and Dragon Age Inquisition. That is a complete array of types of women. And that is the only thing you can say about what we do insofar as romances go, is that we go for something different. Because, you know, well, if I'm honest, because we don't want to keep writing the same thing over and over again. That's all. So that is, I can't make a promise but like that, but I'm like, I hear you. And I can say that when the conversation comes up next, the best thing you can do is convince me. You don't have, you can yell at me till you're blue in the face. You can call me a monster. You can send me rage filled. I don't even know what. And that is not going to be anywhere near as effective. I mean, for all the guys that think that we just succumb to angry SWJs or whatever, I don't even know why they think that, because they're just as angry, and I think they're full of shit. But that's not going to be anywhere near as effective as a kind word and a concern and say, and somebody who actually makes me stop and think, or just makes, you know, full stop there, just makes me stop and think. If they can actually say find a way to get it across to me that doesn't make me feel like shit about myself or about my team or about what I, you know, the game I've made or about life in general, and actually, you know, sparks my imagination, that is how they're gonna have the biggest effect compared to everybody else. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes total sense.
It makes perfect sense.
You know, not to belabor the point, but I think a lot of people that get angry don't understand that, you know, it's not as simple as I'm going to write this thing and they'll be able to cram it into the game and have it make sense because I want it.
Right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, because, you know, my background's in UI. I like to write, but I also understand that games are not simple things to put together. And, you know, Dragon Age is a franchise. It is not simply just a one-off game. So anything that comes after has to fit within that franchise.
Right. I mean, to be fair, we determine what fits within that franchise.
Sure.
Like, I can't say, the reason there are no Asians is because there can't be. No, we created where we set it in a part of the world where there are no Asian people, that within easy reach anyway. We allowed players to be them, but you don't see them around. And somebody says, "Well, why do you include Asian people?" It's like, well, yes, you're absolutely right. We made the active choice to have a limited breadth to our portrayal. Yes, we don't have any Asian people. Could we do something different? Yes, we absolutely could. I mean, at this point, the setting is set.
Yeah.
Whether we expand it further is a completely different question. Now, no longer up to me, but there's sort of that you can't make the excuse of, it's like the tail wagging the dog. It's like, oh, I'm going to go back to something. Why does Quiet dress in a bikini? Well, of course, it's because she has some disease that requires her to breathe through her skin. Oh, okay. So you decided she would have that disease then at some point, yes? That is a completely different conversation. But, I mean, I think that's a rather difficult argument to make.
Yeah, especially when Kojima's like, you're all going to be so ashamed. And I'm like, just admit that you wanted to see tits. We'll all accept that truth versus the silly-ass reason you gave us.
I don't want to suppose what his reasoning was, so I was back away carefully from that.
No, I've said it on other podcasts, but it's just, you know, the reason given versus, oh my God, you'll be so ashamed, I was like, no, okay.
Well, I mean, for me, I just think that saying... I forget there's a the logical argument, but it is at the end because of how it began. We decided how it began, so we're sort of responsible for what we decided was possible. So we can't then say, well, that's impossible because it's like this. Well, yeah, but because you made it like that. It is a self-reinforcing fallacy, right? So
yeah.
You just have to be careful when you're at the beginning. I wish... it wasn't, I mean, I remember when I made Dragon Age Origins, I wish that this had been more of a conversation back then, because maybe it's something I would have thought about back then, although I was specifically told, make a European, quasi-European, quasi-medieval kind of fantasy IP, not a something else entirely. And I mean, but, you know, it's not like, oh, there were no minorities in Europe during the medieval ages. That's not true. But I was thinking Tolkien, I guess. It's hard to go back to that mindset. It's like when people say, why weren't there more gay people in, I don't know, Baldur's Gate? It's like, well, because that was 1999. It wasn't even a blip on anybody's radar. It just wasn't done. It's like trying to transport your mindset to the past when it was like life was a little different, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we know that you're working on a new IP and you can't talk about it. And I'm not going to ask you to break confidence, but you know, well, yes, that would be terrible of me. But
you can ask
me, you can just do like Mike Laidlaw says in spoilers. Just that will be the answer.
Yeah. Well, Mike's more of a troll than I am, but I would just smile, and you can't even see that because this is audio.
Yeah. I don't know if you ever watch him stream on Twitch. It's hilarious.
I watched him play, what was the game? RimWorld on Twitch. And I thought, there went 30 hours of my life, I think. I find his Twitch stream to be delightful. He's an easy person to listen to.
Yeah, he's fun. So since you can't talk about the IP, let's just have a totally fun, silly question to end this part on.
Okay.
If you could make any game, let's say Mike gave you unlimited budget or some other studio tried to woo you away from BioWare and said you can make anything you want, what would it be?
Okay. In order?
Sure.
Or am I limited to a single? That's hard. This is not a fun question for me. This is serious cat question, okay?
Okay.
Number one, KOTOR 3.
Okay.
Okay. Number two, Shadowrun.
Really?
Yeah, Shadowrun is a deep, dark love of mine. The fact that they made a Shadowrun RPG, they've made two, or the second one coming out? Did I miss one? The last one was Denver, no?
No, Dragonfall is out, right?
That was the last one.
No, the last one is Hong Kong. No. Dragonfall was originally an expansion to the first one that they lengthened.
Have I missed a Shadowrun game? I have. Wow. All right, I know what I'm doing for the next week. All right, so, but, you know, Shadowrun, like a Shadowrun MMO or something, wow. If somebody said that to me first, I would sort of float around the room for a while. They'd be on the phone like, hello, hello, hello. I don't know. I don't even know what I would say. And lastly, a zombie apocalypse game set in the Victorian era. No, never mind Victorian. Guardian era, where your primary goal is not to defeat the zombies. It's to find husbands for all your girlfriends who themselves may or may not be zombies.
Huh.
Yeah. And the only weapon you have is a parasol, and perhaps relying on valiant men to sort of throw themselves in the zombies' path and get eaten so you can not get blood on your dress. I think that'd be great.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. You can sort of whack a zombie with your parasol and they're sort of momentarily stunned and they'll allow you to go by. And sort of, I want these scenes where, you know, there's a whole bunch of the class upper crust of Edwardian society that, you know, their servants are all getting munched on by zombies, but they refuse to acknowledge that the zombies are in the room because that would be gauche. So they continue to play Twist and talk about, you know, who you may or may not be marrying when the game is over.
Okay, I kind of wish I had the money to throw at you to make this game.
I know, right? You could tell I've given this a lot of thought.
I've been meaning to win.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I kind of miss... I kind of think that people talk about, like, well... Could you do more with romances? I'm like, no, not without making romance sort of the point of the game. But I think then the balance makes me think, what if you did make a game where romance was sort of a central feature? Like, I wouldn't want to make it like the romance simulator, like you know, that Japanese pigeon game or something. But it's like, what if there was a game you could make that was an RPG that sort of focused on romantic adventure instead of just adventure? I don't know. That sort of goes, makes me go, Because like people always talk like there's a female audience that is yet to sort of be fully exploited, which is a great word. Like, yeah, well, but what if you made a game that was deliberately aimed at them? It's sort of not being sort of in a pandering kind of way, like let's make it pink and say, hey, romance for the girls. But what about a game that was sort of like badass and a romantic adventure and still a XXX game? And not, you know, sort of condescending or patronizing. That would be cool. And, you know, have put a, you know, I don't even know. I'm running out of rabbit hole in my head right now. But so any one of those things, but preferably KOTOR 3.
Okay. I'm just visualizing the zombie game because I'm like, I've been meaning to learn Twine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I should write it in Twine, shouldn't I? That'd be great.
Yes. Yeah. So we have been talking for a long time, so I will try to be No, it's great. It's like I don't care. I'm having a great time, but I'm sure you like, have stuff to do.
Oh, my God, has it been 2 hours? Holy crap.
Yeah.
There was a couple of rants in there, so I don't apologize, but that's, in case anybody's listening, should you feel weary at this point saying, fuck, this guy can talk, I will apologize for all the rants. It happens sometimes. This is, I sometimes in the writer's pit, I'm known as the anti, I will come in and be the anti productivity manager, because it's like I will stand up and everybody in the room will look at me and I'll say, what the hell is with Sailor Moon? And there goes half an hour.
That's pretty fun, though. I mean,
yeah, well, I can do that.
That's true. So we
usually, believe it or not, usually there is a point that relates to work. It's tangential, yes, but there is a point. Something prompted this. It's not like I sit there thinking about Sailor Moon just because.
Hey, I can't judge. I'm usually thinking about video games 90% of the time when I'm at work. So,
yeah.
So we got a couple questions, but this one is just in the vein of having kind of a silly, fun end toward the end of our discussion, because the two articles we have linked, and I'll leave it in the show notes, we've actually kind of touched on those topics already about engaging with players and internet teen angst. So I'll still leave those in the show notes for people to read, but we kind of talked about that stuff anyway.
Okay.
Unless you had strong feelings about either article, and we can still talk about them. But Tyler Pollock, Cyberpunk Warlock on Twitter, asked, who has the best butt in each Mass Effect and Dragon Age game?
That's difficult to answer because mostly they have the same butt. It was like they generally used the same body morph, didn't they? It's like Wynn, our quote-unquote old lady from Dragon Age Origins. I think that the one banter where Zevran talks about her magical bosom came about the day after I saw the model she would use. And I'm like, wow, look at the tits on that lady. Of course, they're the same tits everybody else has, but it's like, okay, but comparatively, you know, it puts them in a new context that they're on her body. And the artist is like, yeah, but we don't, that's the only body we have. I'm like, well, could you cover her up? And he's like, well, we don't really, but like for an old gal, she's showing a lot of cleavage. And he's like, well, yeah, we don't have it. You'd be like, yeah, you didn't make any other outfits that didn't show any cleavage, huh? But that is a separate question. But I was like, okay, I'm writing Zevran at the moment, and so I'm going to talk about her magical bosom because there's clearly magic involved. I just gotta say. But I'm talking tits now, not in someone's ass. Best time. Mass Effect, I think, did have different body morphs, so they did have different asses. And someone says, what, Garrus? No, Garrus had those. Garrus frightened me. He had like mandibles. How can you kiss Garrus with those mandibles that are slicing up your face? I don't even understand. And then, what's the alternative? Fishman? No. No. Jacob had the best ass. I mean, it was very prominent, very shiny, as I recall. Best butt in Dragon Age. Let me think. Though they definitely all had the same ass. But who showed it more? Maybe Sebastian. Sebastian Vale. I don't know why I think about his ass, but I seem to recall it being well framed by his white armor. Yeah. So I'll go with that.
Yeah, there's someone who made a mod that swaps the walk animation.
good, because that sort of that swishy walk they gave the gals is like, what is that even? I don't even understand.
But Sebastian wears it very well.
Oh, was that the one where we're doing the slow walk and then he does this sort of slinky?
Yes.
Slinky Catwoman kind of walk.
I don't know about. There was a GIF someone made of it slowed down where basically the woman's walk animation worked out on Sebastian incredibly well.
I see. Okay.
So just for those listening, the two articles we had was a Goblin Sutra article that's 8 tactics for engaging players on social media. And we actually talked with Alan Shoemaker a bit about that. So did you get a chance to look at that article or did you see it by chance?
I've seen it. Yep. I will admit freely that I did not read the entire thing. I like read parts of it. I was like, okay. And then I think I got interrupted and I never got back to it.
That's more than fair. Did you have any thoughts on the bit you did read or you just kind of want to move on?
No, let's move on.
Okay. And then the other article is thoughts on internet teen angst because, well, the internet and the state of the internet and gaming the last 9 months has been kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
So
it was very difficult. I did the idea of growing up surrounded by not only like, because there's, I don't think this is, well, I guess this is the first generation that's sort of growing up online. But if you're really young, the amount of intensity in the online world has sort of spiked dramatically. And I can't even imagine what it'd be like to be young and be sort of surrounded by that. I mean, I am 43 years old, and I find it difficult to engage with that, the sort of the intensity of online interaction, and I make lots of missteps. What if you were like 14? That's a completely different thing, isn't it?
I don't want to be 14 ever again, let alone online.
Yeah.
No, I just, I mean, I watch a lot of TED Talks, and Monica Lewinsky was talking about that. You know, when she was 22, when Bill Clinton happened, and her life went to shambles.
In front of her. Contemplated suicide.
Yeah. Sorry, the sound cut out for a second, so I don't know. I hope I didn't cut you off.
Oh, no, you were a little choppy there, but it was fine.
Okay. So, yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, a lot of the stupid shit I've said as a teenager, thankfully, is nowhere online because I'm actually just a year younger than you. So I am very glad my teenage years are not online.
Yeah, if I think if the internet had existed when I was 14, oh my god, maybe those stupid short stories I wrote that got me my job, they would be online for people to review, look back, and say, wow, look at Gator, he thinks he's some kind of writer. Look at this shitty road. Oh my god, I'd be like inside, be like, I wrote them when I was 14.
Yeah.
Like, oh, there's no excuse. You're a professional. I wasn't then. Oh my god.
Oh yeah. I'm anything I've written prior to probably 2002 is buried under a fanfiction.net profile no one should ever find.
Like the porn story I wrote. Oh, well, that probably requires an explanation.
Yeah.
I have mentioned it online, so it's not new. After my first two novels, my editor, we were talking about, it was a sex scene. And she said, you know, you write your sex scenes are very Canadian. I'm like, oh, you will have to explain that. She says, well, you seem to approach them like a teenage boy at a dance. It's like you sort of nervously looking at the sex scene across the dance floor. If it looks your way, you look away. It's like you don't want to make direct eye contact. And it comes across. And I'm like, oh, that's brutal. Yeah. She's like, yeah. So it was fine. She was totally right. I mean, she said my sex scenes were like a nervous handshake. And I'm like, well, okay. What do I do about that? She says, you just need to go write some porn. Some ass-slapping porn, write it under a pseudonym, I don't even care, but just get out of your system, because you're not going to write anything quite like that in the book, but maybe you should just do it and get it out there. And I'm like, okay. So I did, and there is porn that I have written that is online. I'm not going to say where. You know, it's not Dragon Age. When I mentioned it the first time, people said, oh my god, is it Dragon Age porn? No! Why would I write porn about my own characters? Those are like my children. Good god, no. No, it's not Dragon Age, but it is out there under a pseudonym. You will never know it's me, and I will never reveal it. And I am happy knowing that it's there. And it's gotten some decent reviews. And one review that someone very helpfully pointed out all the things that I did that sucked. That I read it, I was like, oh, the earlier ones were much more complimentary, and this one just sort of ripped my soul out. And it made me feel good because, you know, all the other ones were like, this is great, this is hot. It's like, well, I don't really believe it. And this person came in and said, oh, this is shit, and this is why. Oh, I believe you. And I think that's probably indicative of some aspect of my psyche. I should probably relate to my psychologist. But hey. Regardless, it's there and I did it. And that's really the entire story.
It was something I didn't know. So, hey, it works.
There you go. David Gator has written porn.
Like most of us. So.
Well, but not anywhere near as good as most of you. Let's be honest. I mean, my porn is terrible. I think anybody who read my novels can figure that out.
Oh, God.
I'm just being honest.
I know, I just didn't expect you to say it. Oh, God. Oh, I don't want to stop talking. Like, this is hilarious. Because I will say this on record. I was terrified about today.
Really? Why?
Well, okay, so I don't know how much you talk with, like, maybe Ellen or other devs, but, like, I've got... What?
I did talk to Alan about his time on the show.
Yeah, but, like, Ellen and I actually, like, G-chat on occasion and chat about other things and, like, just BioWare stuff. So, like, there's not the reciprocal relationship that I have with some of the devs. So I was, like, terrified of, like, okay, this is David Gator. He doesn't know me very well. And, you know, you answered yes to a random tweet, and I was very excited. So it was just more of a, okay, I can't fuck this up.
Well, fair enough.
But here we are, over 2 hours later, having a great conversation that I don't want to end.
Well, my ears are starting to get sweaty from these headphones. We'll have to beg off at some point.
Well, we're at the end, really. And what we always kind of wrap up with is, you know, just talking about what we're playing very briefly. And then, you know, of course, where to find you as our guest and ourselves online. So have you had time to play anything recently? Or?
Oh, yeah, I have to. I mean, I am. I wouldn't say contractually, but sort of obligated by virtue of my position to check out what other games are doing. I find it hard. Like I just finished Arkham Knight.
Okay.
Oh God, I hate that Batmobile. I have to sort of play games that I don't. I enjoyed it. I won't say that I didn't, but I have to play games that I might not ordinarily pick up on my own. Just because it's sort of like I don't want to. Somebody asks me, says, "Well, what's the last RPG you played?" And I'm like, "Well, let me think. No, I have to see what other games are doing. I have to go back and finish Witcher 3. Actually, soon I will be playing Shadowrun Hong Kong. I suspect. what was I doing before that? Well, if I'm honest, Crusader Kings 2.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's my go-to game that I just never seem to get tired of for some reason.
There's always that one game where it's like no matter what you're doing, you can always just kind of go back to it.
Yeah. Oh, and right before Arkham Knight, I finished what was that? It was the RPG Pillars of Eternity.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I did not finish it because I reached this one near the end battle, I believe, that it was just so goddamn hard and I couldn't do it. I'm going to have to punch Chris Avellone next time I see him. But I got most of the way through the game, and I'm satisfied with that. I'm just not lead enough to finish it, I guess, which is too bad because it was cool.
I understand because I can't beat the boss in Descent.
Oh really?
Yeah, no matter what I do, what team I pick, it's a team wipe, like in anywhere from a few seconds to a few minutes.
Oh, that's sad.
It is because like I'm. It's the only DLC I haven't beat, really. Like, the dragon fights, everything else. And I was just like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to go play Trespasser, which is what I did.
Yeah.
It made me cry a little bit. I love it. I ran through with my first Inquisitor, which was a Dalish Elf. And I'm actually going through, and I'm going to stream this playthrough as well, of my human maid. Our human warrior is the only other save file I have because I lost a bunch of saves.
Oops.
Yeah, if you have a PS4, make sure you back up everything before you swap hard drives. I learned that the hard way.
So, I've never played DAI.
What?
I've never played DAI. I mean, after it was released, I played it hundreds of times prior to that, but once I've never played any of the games I've worked on after they've been released.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, by that time, I'm so sick of it. I just can't wait for it to get out the door. I mean, seriously, if you'd played DAI 100 times, I think you'd be sick of it, too.
Oh, yeah.
Let's be honest. And most of the time when I played it, it was broken and it really sucked.
Yeah, you did not get the final shipped version.
No, I mean, there's a part of me, when, like, as soon as it gets like close to being done, where I kind of have this urge, like, I want to go back and see what it's like when it actually all works. And the cinematics are done and not everybody's standing around in T-pose. And, you know, their face, their eyeballs don't suddenly start floating 3 inches outside of their face and things like that. I think that would be neat. And then I start playing and it's like, no, I think I'm good.
Maybe.
Usually by that point, I've already moved on to the next project anyway.
Yeah. And then, as I mentioned before, I'm playing Metal Gear Solid, although I had to put it down. I'm going to go back to The Witcher 3. Because that mission to get the skilled prisoner that allows you to play as a woman, I cannot beat that right now. There's about 2 hours of me on YouTube cussing like a sailor about this mission.
You see.
Well, I rescued her, got killed, and it didn't count. So I was not happy.
Oh.
Yeah.
That would really suck.
Yeah.
I mean, like, me doing the final racing mission of an Arkham Knight where I could finally save Catwoman from the Riddler.
Uh-huh.
And that, oh man, I was swearing like you wouldn't believe towards the end. Just beginning towards the end, it's a timed race where you're like doing half of it upside down. And of course I get all dizzy when I play that. So I'm like, I'm trying to keep it straight and I got my head twisted around. So I'm looking at my TV upside down just so I can sort of play that section and not fall. And I was getting towards the end, this one time, and I ran out of time right prior to hit it. And then Riddler goes, "You fail." Oh man, did I scream?
Oh, I can imagine. Do you still have a TV left?
Yes.
Okay.
My neighbors were probably concerned because I think I was like, "You fucking whore," something like that. I just lost it on the Riddler.
Wow.
I was almost tempted to go finish all those stupid riddle side things that were spread around the world just to have the final confrontation with him, but I wasn't motivated enough to do that.
Okay.
So I just left those alone. Yeah. But I was, for that moment, if it had been possible for me to run around quickly and get all those various Riddler things just so I could defeat him, I probably would have done it and stayed up till like 5 a.m. to do it.
Okay. I haven't touched Metal Gear since. But I also stream a lot, so I want to go back to Witcher 3 because it's somewhere in the middle of the plot, and I guess I should get Geralt out of the bog.
Yeah, I have to go back to that as well. I've been away from it long enough that I'm kind of concerned that I will have lost track of where I was.
Yeah, that's easy to do because I'm too.
Yeah, it's not, I have so many quests on the go. I don't remember what plot I was actually following at the time.
I think I'm at the point where I can go to Skellige, but I'm really too low a level to go there and not just die instantly.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and to round out our evening, David Reeves, what are you playing?
I've been playing Star Wars Uprising. It's that mobile sort of RPG thing.
Oh, yeah.
And I will probably do the last, like, mission of Shadowrun Hong Kong after I record this.
Ooh. Are you sad about XCOM 2 being delayed?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
That was brutal. I got that news. I had actually was thinking of booking some time off of work, and then my friend said, "Well, you don't need to. You know, it got delayed." I was like, "Oh, till when?" He's like, "Well, I think till March or something." I was like, "Oh man, brutal." Although, I mean, as a developer, there's part of me that goes, "That's probably good news because that means the final game will be more polished and a better experience overall, and it probably needed the time to bake." And then there's the fan side of me, which is like, "Ah, you motherfucker." The game. Yeah.
No, I understand, because I was just like, why? I actually speaking of booking time off, I took a week off for Dragon Age Inquisition, and I will probably do that.
Is this right of jest?
Yes. And I'll probably do that for Mass Effect Andromeda. So hopefully by this time next year, though, I will not be in my current job and working for myself, but that's a side tangent. So finally we're at the end. I'm very sad for this to stop, but we all have stuff to do, and I'm actually hungry. So David, where can people find you online?
On Twitter, I'm on at David Gator, and that is really the only place. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Tumblr. So that's it.
Facebook is the devil.
Yeah, I deleted my account.
Wow. I'd love to, but I have too much stuff tied to it now. David Reed.
I had a lot of stuff on it.
I can be found on Twitter at Red Conversation and patreon.com/redconversation. And if you need a fiction editor, I can be reached either at davidlreeves.com, or you can just email me at work@davidlreeves.com.
Cool. And I'm Cypher Tier everywhere, or you can also find me as my alter ego of I Need Diverse Games, which is I Need DIVGMS on Twitter, and our site is ineeddivgms.info, And this has been an amazing 2 hours with David Gator. So thank you so, so much for this, David. It was a wonderful time talking to you.
Well, thanks for the invitation. It was actually pretty fun.
Awesome. Yeah, it was fantastic.
It was. And so we will finally stop this episode because we don't want to be like our friends at Game Enthus and have a 3-hour episode. And yes, I'm talking about you all because being on your show is a marathon. I love you all, but that's a long ass time to talk. So with that, and me being a terrible person and talking about my fellow podcasters, we are ending this episode. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Rest.